Welcome to the special podcast series on culture and the creative economy, sponsored by Netflix. I'm Naka Kondo with Economist Impact. Often our research here focuses on economic trends that are relatively straightforward to measure, analyze, and forecast. But what if those trends exist primarily in the mind? And I'm talking about the creative sector. In the second episode of the series, we're exploring the economic, social, and cultural impacts of fandom. I spoke with two recognized experts in the field, Sam Ford, Executive Director, Accelerate KY Kentucky, USA Research Affiliate, MIT Comparative Media Studies, and Dr. Natalie Collins, who is a senior lecturer at Edith Cowan University School of Business and Law, to try to understand some of the foundational elements of today's fandom and the creative economy. Welcome both to the podcast. So I guess maybe we can just get some definitions out of the way at the beginning. My first question is, what is fandom? Sam, shall we start with you?
It's a good question. And on the one hand, it's very straightforward. Most people listening to this probably have things they would self-declare effusively that they're a fan of. But what is fandom? What does it mean? Does it mean you on an individual level are deeply passionate about something? Or as I would argue, also a strong community element when we're not just saying, oh, I'm a big fan of this. We're talking about fandom. It indicates a shared experience with other people who are also enthusiastic about a media property, a story, a song, a performer, whatever that might be, all the way to potentially brands and marketing. So it can run a wide range of subjects, but it is a shared enthusiasm for a particular creative world or story world.
Natalie, so what is a fan and are they born or made?
Okay, so here is the thing about fans. Everyone thinks they aren't one, but deep down inside, we all have a little bit of fan in us for something, right? Even the coolest cucumber of a person can get really excited about a product, a person, a political belief, or something like that that they have emotional attachment to. So what is a fan? A fan is someone who has emotional attachment to an object, an experience, or a person that's not in their personal life. So it could be a musician. It could be an artist. It could be an iPhone. It can be anything that you would not. It's not your mother. It's not your kid. It's not a personal relationship you're having. It's a relationship you're having with an entity, often a commercial entity. So are they born or made? Well, they're a little bit of both. There's a little bit of fan in everybody. But what you're a fan of is a very individual and specific thing, like your DNA.
Sam, you've distinguished fans versus fandom. And I understand fandom emphasizes the shared collective experience. So how does being a part of this shared experience impact individuals? And does the experience spill over to other aspects of their lives?
Yeah, well, I think there are a few ways to think about this. One is that idea of loving a particular media property or singer or sports team versus sharing that with a community of people. That's the first aspect. I'd also say that sports media play a particular role in our lives. Traditionally, there are some types of media that we engage with primarily to be able to strike up a conversation with a stranger, right? So sports teams have been traditionally done that. The news has traditionally done that. The weather, perhaps. So people, you know, watch or keep up with certain things so they'll have something to talk about in small talk with someone they don't know. In my view, a fandom is often not how you talk to a stranger to have small talk, but rather how do you find your best friends? Who is somebody who shares an enthusiasm, especially for something that may be especially niche? And that's one thing we've certainly seen change in our cultures globally over the course of the last couple of decades, really, is the fact that there is such an overabundance of media content now. We have fewer and fewer things that we can assume a stranger will definitely know so that you can strike up a conversation with anybody about a topic and everybody watches it or listens to it. And we've moved more and more toward this role of when you find somebody who loves this band as much as you do, we can see so much of popular culture as a social glue that helps us explore things we're interested in together, have material fodder to talk to other people about, and really have shared activities to dream together, imagine together.
You know, that is really interesting, and it resonates personally as well. I think these days, even for me personally, I can never assume, just because of the kind of the objective profile of a person, that that person would necessarily be into X or Y or Z. So over to you, Natalie. What is fandom?
So the idea of being a fan has evolved throughout the years, and the internet's obviously taken it to a brand new level. But basically, a fan or a group of fans are people who follow a particular way of life because they identify with a particular product. And that product is part of their internal identity. And that's why I talk about a way of life, right? So, for example, in the United States, the political party that you adhere to is more than just something you put in the ballot box for a lot of people. It is part of who they are. Everywhere in the world, it doesn't matter where you are, sporting teams tend to be like this. And sometimes sporting teams and the sporting teams that you follow bleed out into regular culture, which happens a lot in Scotland with their football teams. So being a fan of something is not just liking something. It's that thing that you like has become part of your identity and who you are. And as a consequence, you identify with it very, very strongly. One of the things about fandom, which is very specific, and it differentiates you from, let's say, just being someone who likes a particular product, is the way you feel about it. That emotional attachment is constructed. In other words, it's not an innate biological drive, like the way you love your mother, for example, right? Or the way you love chocolate, which for me is a biological drive, right? It is something else. Russell Belk is a very, very well-known academic in this area, and he probably pioneered most of the research around fandom in one way or another. He looks at, why are people obsessive and attached to particular things while other people aren't necessarily attached to those things? So, for example, why would one person collect every single Barbie that ever existed, and yet millions of people play with Barbies and don't feel that way? What is it about that person and that product? And he came up with this concept of quintessence. Quintessence is when a product or an experience is so right for you, it's so perfect to you in form and function, that it elevates itself beyond the mundane and the ordinary. It becomes, in a sense, a holy thing, but not in a religious sense, in a sense that it sets it apart from all the others. And when you are engaged with that product, you have a sense of flow, a sense of connection, a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose. It imbues you so much emotionally, consuming it becomes part of your identity. And what some people do is they collect, I want every version of this in every color. What other people do is they tell other people about it. They become product evangelists. So how the behavior manifests itself is actually very, very different based on the person and their predilection. However, the feeling of being imbued with something so perfect, so great that it is elevated, quintessence, is common to all fans.
That is fascinating. And I just want to ask what you've just mentioned about how digital technologies have elevated fandom to a different level. How has that happened and why is it so relevant today?
I think one of the things that's really interesting about the world of science, right, is that people who really love science and science fiction and those kinds of people gathered together and communicated very, very well before the internet. And the reason I'm saying that is because I want to take a moment to talk about Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry built Star Trek, the concept of the show, on this idea that he knew exactly who would like it. Why did he know? Because these people gathered together in person at conventions before there was a Star Trek. There were science fiction conventions. And he knew of these conventions and he understood these people. And he said, I'm going to create a show for these people because I have a built-in audience. Now, today, that happens all the time. Marvel and, you know, I mean, how many iterations of Sherlock Holmes, et cetera, right? But back then, that was actually quite unique. And remember, this was just when color television started as well, right? So the idea of people getting together because they like something and identifying with it is actually much older than Gene Roddenberry, but he's a really good example of how that's leveraged commercially. Once the internet happened, the very basic beginnings of the internet, people got together to talk to each other. Generally speaking, they were getting together to talk to each other about recreational things and sometimes scientific things. Why? Because business always lagged when it came to the internet. So what happens is that these people started getting together to talk about the things they wanted to talk about. And it might have been cars, it might have been computers, it might have been TV shows, it might have been bands. So the internet, as it's developed and gone on, and now we can stream video and audio, we can make parody videos, we can make tribute videos to our favorite artists or TV shows or whatever it is. The idea of what fans can do and create has really exploded. But importantly, fans can find each other. Because you can be a fan by yourself, but the fan experience, that quintessence, is amplified when you're around other people like you. And inevitably, people try to find other people like them because we're social animals.
That is truly, truly fascinating. So fans can find each other and it amplifies the quintessence, as you mentioned. So I guess, do fans, or is the fandom in the age of digital technology conducive in unleashing the creativity of these individuals?
So people have always been very creative about things that touch them, right? Things that occur to them and part of their identity. And I'm going to go back to the science fiction model here. People were writing what's known as fan fiction a long time before the internet started, and they would share it. You know, how would these people communicate with each other? I'm not making this up. They would send letters, okay? And there were newsletters, and there were fan clubs that had newsletters. And although my voice is deceptively young, I am actually rather old. So I remember this era, right? And I was actually a fan of a few things where I received newsletters of these things. Sometimes magazines or commercial publications would cater specifically to a particular kind of person who was a particular kind of fan of something. And then advertisers would advertise in it. People made money doing it, a little bit like ads right now on different websites or affiliates on YouTube or whatever. What happened when digital technology became something that everybody could access? The ability to create things, the ability to share things, and the ability to, in fact, get in touch with the object of your desire, assuming it's a person, right? And not like an object, an actual object, really grew. And so as someone who's a Weird Al Yankovic fan from, I'm not making this up, seventh grade, and trust me when I tell you, again, that was a long time ago, and I recently saw him in concert probably for the fifth time. If I wanted to, I could tweet Weird Al right now. Now, I have nothing constructive to say to him, so I'm just a fan. But that didn't really quite happen in the same way before the internet. You could write to someone. You might get an autographed picture of someone. Richard Simmons, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a little bit of an older icon of fitness. He used to write back to his fans, and quite a few very large personalities did that. But generally speaking, that didn't really happen. Today, not only can that happen, but if I did a little tribute to Weird Al, he might actually see it. And if he likes it, he might retweet it or share it with the rest of his fans. That would have been really, really unusual before digital technology.
This is fascinating. So with recent technologies, fans have now vastly new ways of influencing each other, expressing themselves, and they're not just on the receiving end of entertainment. So how has this impacted how fans define themselves?
Oh, in all sorts of ways. So first of all, in the classic model, you have media industries or professional storytellers who produce content. There's a scarcity of content and only a limited number of distribution channels. And audiences didn't have easy paths to really do anything in and around that content. Now, especially in visible ways. Of course, people always did all sorts of creative things. These creative activities aren't new, but if they were limited to the mixtapes and remixes that you might be able to make on analog devices with the other kids in your neighborhood, then the impact your feedback and remixing might have is limited to a small community, and there was really limited channels to share that work back. You know, that's where the internet really took what had been less visible behaviors and creative practices that had long existed, and suddenly, A, made them more visible and trackable, so that suddenly media producers were seeing that feedback loop and these responses to their content that didn't really get seen previously. But also, to your point, other audiences started to see not just the official stories produced by those companies, but also work created by other fans. My master's thesis and some of my research has been on U.S. daytime soap operas. And time again in audience fan communities online, we would see people say, I keep watching the show, not always because I enjoy the show, but I enjoy all of the creative production and practices and discussion around the show. So in a way, instead of thinking about the primary material was the show, and then the fans were producing stuff around it, it was almost like the primary material for some of these audiences were actually the fan-produced content, and they watched the show because it was the only way they could understand and enjoy all the stuff fans then made in response. That is a really interesting phenomenon, and it raises all sorts of questions for people who work in the creative industries. How do you listen to that? How do you make sense of that feedback? How do you respond? When do you respond? When do you incorporate that feedback? And it also creates, in return, there's an expectation from fans that when you say something in response to the stories you love, you may somehow be able to impact or shape the direction of the content that's being produced.
I've always been interested in the dynamics of the power of the media producer and the power of the consumer, and how these interactions kind of moves in unpredictable ways. But how do you see this dynamic playing out now and going forward?
A lot of my work has been on the realm of professional wrestling. And one of the reasons professional wrestling fascinates me is because it is a fictional story world, with each new installment written by a team of writers or creative producers and carried out by actors. But this is a televised, a media-produced performance that has a live crowd. And that live crowd component becomes important because the people who are attending these events, they know what they're watching is scripted. But they also know that they actually have a scripted role to play. So if you're watching a pro wrestling show streaming on television, the live audience plays a really important role, and they are supposed to play the part of a sports fan. And so they're cheering for the person they're rooting for. They're reacting to what's happening with the twists and the turns in the storyline. But what you see happening is wrestling fans realize over time that they have power because, especially in wrestling, it's a particularly overt. There are, let's say, 20,000 people in an arena, and the writers have written the storylines expecting what they want the fans in the arena to do for the production that is being watched by the spectators on a screen. But the fans in the arena, they're not on payroll. In fact, they're paying to be there. So if they don't want to go along with what the writers want them to do, they can take it a different direction. They can boo the person who is supposed to be the hero. They can cheer for someone who's supposed to be the villain. They can take the person who's supposed to be a side character and suddenly cheer for them in a way that elevates them to sounding like they're the biggest star on the show. And that fascinates me because then you see fans start to organize. Hey, you know, they're treating this person. We think she's one of the best performers on the show, and they're putting her in the opening match, or she's always losing. Fans may say, you know, we're going to really organize around seeing her given a bigger push. Or they're really trying to push this person as a hero, and we hate this character, so we're going to chant boring every time he comes out. And so, you know, you're a TV writer, you're trying to produce something, and you build up this person as being the big hero, and all the fans chant boring when he comes out. It's hard to ignore that, right? You've got to suddenly adjust the script or find some way to acknowledge and incorporate that feedback that fans are producing. So it creates all these new dynamics that are ultimately a power struggle of sorts between audiences and the writers. And that is a particularly overt example because the fans literally are in the text. They're on the show. But you see a similar dynamic play out in pretty well every fandom where you have this sort of balance or power struggle that can exist between the writers and elements of the fandom. And that's the other thing. None of these fandoms are monolithic, right? There are different factions and different opinions amongst the fan base. So then you also see fans sort of policing their own community and talking about what is or isn't permissible. And you start to have all these interesting, almost ethical debates rise up around fandom.
So, Natalie, another thing I would love to understand is that the object of fandom, I understand, could be anything. Why would it be relevant, beneficial even, for everyone, including businesses and policymakers, to understand fandom today?
So why would a business person want to know this? And my degree, my terminal degree is in business. So you could see that this topic got a lot of legs in business. It's simply because you can make money, right? Once people are identifying with you emotionally, your ability to make money from them increases. A lot of people like to think that they're reasonable, that they're rational actors, and in many areas of our life, we are. But in some areas of our life, we are actually irrational actors. And if I can get your irrational part to give me money, that's a good thing because I can then leverage that over and over. It's like a button that I can press. Now, that sounds a little evil, but it's not necessarily, because if it's giving you pleasure, then that could be a good thing. For example, if I create a sports bra, which is absolutely feeling amazing, and it makes you want to wear it all the time, which makes you want to go to the gym more because you want to experience what the brand is about, that's great, right? But if I make a cigarette that does that, well, some people might have a problem with that. So what business does with it is an open question and sometimes an ethical question. But in the end, what marketers try to do is they try to get you to do what they want you to do. Marketing is about one thing, and it's behavioral change. The biggest thing in the world is inertia. The easiest thing to do is to do what's been done. Marketers try to get you to do something, whether it's click something, watch something, buy something, eat something. There are certain things, you know, that happens when you're a fan of something or that fans are collective. One of the things, for example, is they give themselves a name, a collective name. So Jimmy Buffett, who's a singer, his followers were called Parrotheads. The Grateful Dead, their followers were called Deadheads, right? These were an organic name that people call themselves. But by the time Lady Gaga came out, she had a name for the people who followed her. She anticipated who her fans were. She called them her little monsters. And there was a reason why she chose that name. It worked very well with the kinds of people who she wanted to follow her, which were very avant-garde. So one of the things to bear in mind is that today, commercial entities aren't only leveraging fans. They're trying to create them from the outset. And one of the ways they do this is to say, my fans are special. They're smarter. They're better looking. They're more tuned in. They're more fashionable. They're more avant-garde, whatever, right? Now, anytime there's a group of fans, there's going to be a lot of people who aren't fans. And so one of the ways that a parrot head, for example, would differentiate themselves from a non-parrot head is to say, I am part of this very special group of parrot heads. So I lived in Australia for a long, long time, like, you know, over 20 years, and I am a Jimmy Buffett fan. I am a parrot head. I don't walk around and tell people this because A, young people don't know who Jimmy Buffett is, but also B, not a lot of people listen to Jimmy Buffett in the circles that I move in and in the place that I live. And yet one day I was talking to a deputy vice chancellor of research, and I said something that came from a Jimmy Buffett song. And he turned to me very carefully and said, are you a parrot head? And I said, yes. And he said, so am I. And instantly we had a connection. I had a code. I unlocked the key, didn't mention Jimmy Buffett's name. And he and I shared something profound and special about ourselves in that moment. How great is that?
That is super powerful, and it makes me want to be a fan of something. So now turning to Sam, because many people might still think fandom is really just about the niche community of fans, but I think we're understanding here that today, this day and age, that it's relevant and important for perhaps policymakers and businesses, or even people in the financial sector to understand the power and dynamics of fandom. Why do you think this is?
The old media model was often collect as many people as possible and then count them. How many of them are they and what do we know about them? And if you get as many as possible of the desired demographic, that sort of spells your result. What you see with many fandoms is you say a smaller audience that is especially passionate may be willing to spend more income, more time, more engagement around a media property. So that creates whole new types of business strategies, which is really about how deep can you make the experience? How much discretionary income will people be willing to spend against the things they're most passionate about? So it opens up much more of a dynamic that is about a transmedia story world, media that goes across multiple platforms, that is about deepening the experience of engaging in that fandom. But I take the question even more broadly than that, which is to say, a few decades ago, many of these ways of engaging were especially invisible and niche as digital culture made many of these fandom practices more widespread. The ways that people engaged on message boards in the early internet around their favorite fandoms aren't that different than how people are communicating about their work life on Slack today. So some of the projects that I'm working on currently with a group that at the University of Southern California that Henry Jenkins helped found called the Civic Imagination Project. At the core of that project is to say, how have the ways that people engaged around fandom shaped how people protest political issues around the world, how people make sense of social issues that they care about. In that way, so many of these entertainment texts become fodder for talking about things that matter in our lives. And that's how so many of these story worlds become inspiration. Maybe utopian. You can certainly see Wakanda Forever as a current example of people talking about representation in new ways, having dreams for an idealized alternate world. You can see the same sort of experience play out around a property like Ted Lasso to talk about this sort of power of optimism and niceness and positivity. You can see dystopian worlds take shape, like the ways in which Hunger Games and the rise against oppression have shaped how people talk about political uprisings around the world. Or you can look to how people have drawn on The Handmaid's Tale to talk about treatment of women in cultures around the world. So it's important to understand pop culture and fandom, because more than likely it is going to spill over into whatever realm of work you're in, policy work, corporate culture, whatever sector you're in, understanding the markets. When you have some of the most prominent business leaders in the world regularly communicating by memes that make references to pop culture that not everybody's going to understand, you start to see the power of how people are expressing their opinions, their creativity, their protest through references ultimately to pop culture.
Thank you, Sam. Natalie, I wanted to go back to you with, again, this question. So are fans ultimately born or made in the sense that can businesses plan or create fans, or do they tend to grow more organically?
Well, I can give you another example, okay? The difference between Star Wars and Star Trek, which is, you know, a battle for the ages, right? Bit of a joke that some people like both, but most are in one camp or another. And Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek for the science fiction convention fans, as I've said. And he built into it all of these kind of ideals of the 60s, right? He was the first one to have Russians and Americans on the bridge together, which ironically now is still a divisive issue. The first interracial kiss on television was on Star Trek, right? A lot of the concepts and the ideas that they explored were very new, or at least they were new to television. Because what Gene Roddenberry wanted to do was not just get fans, he wanted to push the boundaries. And actually, his fans really liked that, right? They were into that. George Lucas put together Star Wars as a space opera. He did it based on a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces that was written by a guy named Joseph Campbell. This book was really important because it described a formula for storytelling, which almost always resonates because it started with religion and the Bible and pre-biblical era. Joseph Campbell talked about myths that resonated over and over throughout every culture. So what George Lucas did is he created a space opera based on what? A sure bet story. His job wasn't to push boundaries other than for special effects. He wasn't looking at groundbreaking storylines or pushing political boundaries or even social or cultural boundaries. He wanted to stay right in that niche because he wanted this to be as popular as possible. And one of the things he did, which was super, super smart, is when he negotiated his TV deal, he kept rights to all the merchandise, which in that time did not happen because he knew that's where he'd be making a lot of his money, from the fans. So again, you can see the difference in these two things, and you can see how they are crafted to resonate and why, and they are each authentic in their own way. But I think one of the things that's really important, and authenticity is something else that I do a lot of research on, is that authenticity is crafted, right? It doesn't mean that it's false. It means that it's deliberate. People really love it when you craft something on the outside that looks the way you are on the inside.
How do companies know who will be a fan, and how can businesses and companies hopefully make more fans? Is that beneficial for them? And is that something that they should aim for, or think about, or care about?
Well, it's interesting you asked that question, because this was the very question that my PhD focused on. So here is the short answer. The short answer is probably only about 10% of the people who use a product are going to be fanatical about it. It is, in fact, a minority. They are, however, a vocal minority. And when I say vocal, I don't just mean they spread word of mouth. Some do, some don't. But they talk back a lot. They want that engagement. If you have a business that has 100 customers and 10 or 15 customers care that much about you, you're doing pretty well, right? If only 5 care that much about you, they're just still doing pretty well, right? Because that 5 is going to create a lot of noise, a lot of activity, a lot of relationship, a lot of engagement. So finding out who these people are is really beneficial to you. One of the things that fans want to do is they want to help you, and you can shape what that help looks like. At the beginning days of Apple, when the personal computer was something that was more of a novelty, Apple really encouraged user groups to get together to help each other, right? This promoted the Apple brand, but it also created a tech support network for the people using their machines. So it's things like that that you can get them to do. Now, how do you know who your fans are? Well, these days, it's pretty simple. They'll usually subscribe to things like your Facebook page or your Instagram or any one of your socials. They'll engage with you. They'll come to your stores if it's a brick and mortar, or they'll write to you, or they'll reach out to you. They may be frequent purchasers, and today, a lot of purchasing is tracked. And just because you're a frequent purchaser doesn't mean you're a fan, but it's one indicator. They may wax lyrical about you. They may make a video about you or talk about you. So there are many ways to do this. It is a good idea to be a bit strategic and tactical about how you're going to engage them and what these people are going to do. And it's also a good idea to have somebody who keeps tabs on them, keeps the community rich, keeps it happening, pumps new information and new content into the community, and makes sure that they weed out anybody who may be poisoning the well.
Thank you so much. Natalie, it was lovely speaking to you. Sam, any final words from you?
I think to your point, we could probably have a fun conversation about this for however long, because this is an endlessly fascinating world and there are so many different ways of looking at it, right? Seeing how you don't want to present fandom in only wholly positive ways, because there are all sorts of ways that fandoms reinforce social hierarchies, that clashes between different factions of a fan community can create toxic environments that make people afraid to participate, that include some people and exclude others. These are complicated spaces like any human community. Fans often over time feel an ownership of sorts of the media worlds that they're responding to, may even see themselves as stewards of those media worlds. That has both positive and negative connotations when people are sort of see themselves as stewards of a cultural tradition. Those are often about protecting boundaries. So you can see these tensions within fandom between protecting story worlds, guiding what would or wouldn't be permissible for that story world, what can or can't happen, what are the rules of that story world, versus people who want to engage in a multiplicity of retellings and reimagining. So we're really using, whether it's a K-pop band or Nigerian cinema or a Turkish soap opera, whatever it might be, a Latin American telenovela, you are using those narratives to talk about a whole lot of things that are happening in our culture.
This has been fantastic. Thank you, Sam.
Appreciate you having me.
Many thanks to Sam Ford and Dr. Natalie Collins for joining us today, and thank you for listening. For more episodes on the Culture and the Creative Economy series supported by Netflix, please visit impact.economist.com/perspectives. You can also find the link in the show notes. Hope to see you again next time. Goodbye.